because the climate camp isn't just about targeting a big power station on one day. It's putting a demonstration of the kind of society that we're looking towards.
Welcome to the 2 Degrees Show, the UK's only weekly show dedicated to climate change. This week we're going to flash back to August and the Camp for Climate Action. Over 10 days, hundreds of people gathered in a makeshift camp in Yorkshire under the shadow of the huge cooling towers of the Drax Power Station, the single biggest point source emitter of carbon dioxide in the UK, and the biggest coal-fired power station in Europe. Apart from the direct action against the power station, which achieved a high profile in the mainstream media, the camp also served as a learning space with around 150 workshops on topics ranging from peak oil to permaculture and from European decentralised energy systems to climate science for kids. The camp also served as a model of how to organise an event with the least environmental impact possible. Virtually all the camp's energy needs were provided by renewable energy sources. Food was vegan and locally sourced. Toilet materials were donated to local farms as a compostable resource. And a grey water system was set up to clean up the camp's dirty water. I had the pleasure of visiting the site for one day, and I took the opportunity to interview some of the people responsible for the camp's sustainable infrastructure. At the next half hour, you'll hear Chan, Bob and Tom explaining how they put it all together. So maybe you can talk us through what there is here and what is being used to power.
We have a homemade wind turbine here. It's a Hugh Piggott design. Hugh Piggott's a pretty famous bit of a guru, really, for homemade wind turbines.
It's about 4 metres high or something?
Oh, a lot more than that. Yeah. Well, maybe 8 metres tall, and each blade is maybe a metre long.
Okay.
In theory, it can produce up to maybe a kilowatt. Obviously, it varies hugely depending on the weather. We haven't really had consistent strong wind, but we've had quite a few gusts, particularly when the storms come in. Today has been pretty quiet. We're actually using the wind turbine to charge a large bank of batteries. The generator itself produces 12 volts DC, which is standard car battery voltage. So it's designed to basically work with car battery equipment because it's very common and quite cheap.
Okay.
The batteries then go through an inverter, which is a device that converts 12 volt DC into mains. That mains is currently used to provide power to the communications tent for charging walkie-talkies, mobile phones, laptops, and... Oh, the wind's picked up again, so it's actually starting to give a reasonable amount of power now. It's very hard to tell how much power we're getting because we don't... It's a homemade piece of kit, it doesn't have any...
Didn't build a meter into
any data logging. We've actually put something in that measures the current, but that just gives you an instantaneous reading. So, for example, I looked at it earlier and it was giving 10 amps. 10 amps at 12 volts means 120 watts.
Okay.
The comms tent is actually taking only 25 watts. And that's enough to charge maybe 10, 15 walkie-talkies or phones. However, on average, the wind turbine's been giving far, far less than that 120 watts. We also have here... an array of solar panels, which are also used to charge batteries in the same location. We have two BP solar crystalline panels. The crystalline panels are the black ones, which give more power than the amorphous panels, which are the blue ones. Basically, the blue ones are of a not such a high quality construction, and therefore are cheaper, but give less power. Each evening, we face the panels ready for the morning sun. Then round about lunchtime, move the panels to face the afternoon and evening sun. Each morning we check the batteries to see which ones are low, put those onto charge. The charged batteries are then given to people who take them out carry them across the field in a wheelbarrow and put an inverter onto power a projector to show films.
I've seen people doing that.
They get through a battery pretty quickly with a projector, even though it's a low energy projector, it's only drawing 150 watts, where 300 to 600 watts is actually more standard. But
so you said there was some other stuff around elsewhere around the site as well?
There is. Over the far side of the site in the well-being area, there's six very large panels. They're connected to six batteries. They're actually with an inverter, but along with the inverter is actually a smart piece of electronics called a charge controller. That enables you to tell how much power you've received from the sun, how much power you've given out. It also automatically protects your batteries, because if you overcharge your batteries or if you draw too much power, then you'll permanently damage your batteries. This does it automatically, and it's providing 250 watts of mains. That's been put through a cable. It's a special cable, steel arm around the outside, which runs across the field to the main entertainment area to provide power for bands and lighting at night.
Right.
It then runs.
That must be quite a heavy draw. Energy-wise.
No, 100, 120 watts. It's lighting. It depends what lighting and what musical equipment you use. Most of the music is acoustic, so we're just using microphones, a little bit of guitar amplification. The lighting is just LEDs, colour LEDs on strings, and also
they're very low.
Very low energy, and then one fluorescent tube, which just for brightness to be people be able to work on. From there, there's a feed to Indie Media to give them power.
And they're running a whole series of laptops off of them, aren't they?
Well, Indie Media are running 12 laptops and a server, a satellite uplink. However, they are running those from a biodiesel generator next door, which is used to power a cinema. So that is used a few hours a day for internet access. The rest of the time they have 250 watts of solar power available to them.
And that's and that, that covers the whole energy needs of the sites, pretty much?
Well, in the neighbourhoods, for example, on the gate, I put a 12-volt battery and a 12-volt energy-efficient light, so that at night when they need to, they can switch a light on. Most of the time they'll be just sitting by tea lights, a nicer ambient light than a bright electric light, but when needs be, they've got an electric light there. Each of the neighbourhoods has a 12-volt battery and 12-volt energy-efficient lights, or some of the neighbourhoods anyway that want it, just to enable people to wash up and tidy up after it, if people are still working as it gets dark.
And that comes from these renewable systems here that you were talking about walking around the site?
Yes, either from batteries charged here from the solar panels here, or in fact some of the neighbourhoods I've just taken out panels and just left the panel on the battery with a light, as long as they only use the light for a few hours each evening, maybe even 4 to 5, then it's fine, as long as they don't forget and leave the light on all night. There's two other things actually. Down in Veggies is actually a bike power generator that can be used again to charge a battery. That's basically a bike on a stand attached to a car alternator.
How many takers? How many people?
It hasn't been configured yet because I've been too busy
workshopping and stuff.
Mainly keeping the lights on.
Okay.
meeting people's power requirements. But hopefully tonight we'll be doing something called the Carbon Olympics, which will be games centred around people generating power. Just showing how people can generate, how much power people can generate and how much power devices use, which will be quite interesting, I think, using a power meter just to make people aware of the huge difference of the power consumption between an old-fashioned light bulb and an energy-efficient light bulb. The other thing that we've done on site is most of the toilet blocks actually have a solar panel, a battery and a light with a switch.
Okay.
So the idea is that people turn the light on at night. It's fine for it to be on during the night as long as it's turned off in the morning. Obviously most people don't notice in the morning if the light's on because it's hard to tell.
Right, so someone has to go around and check.
Well, the message is getting out there, I think. Okay. And each time I go to the toilet, I can do it. So.
Right, yeah. Well, it's pretty impressive to have accomplished all that.
Thank you.
So you're Patrick from...
Patrick from Nottingham. I work with Veggies, which is a mobile vegan catering collective that caters at festivals and gatherings and all kinds of events for all kinds of people. Everything from funerals and weddings to demos on the street.
So you've been doing this for a few years. Does this particular event pose any particular challenges?
Challenges? The biggest challenge we've found is getting the numbers right, because it could have been anything from none to 2,000. We pitched it at 500 to 750-ish, conservatively. And it's turned out, it's gone up and down, but it's turned out to be probably steady at 400. But it's good to be supporting people like Goosemore Organic, who are a local organic wholesaler who source as much as they can locally. They take back all the packaging to reuse. They're really on the ball environment. They do deliveries in as environmentally friendly way as possible.
Is the food organic as well?
The food's mostly all organic. Mostly locally sourced. I would say that probably none of it has been flown anywhere. Some of it may be shipped from the continent, but it would all be, you know, as good as it can be got.
All right. So cut down on the kind of food miles, and you've
supported local farmers to a great extent. The bread is from a local organic bakery. Everything's sort of being corporately produced. Everything's being produced, actually cooked on site by the camp itself, you know, so there's no kind of commercial caterers coming in to...
And it's all been vegan as well, which...
Everything's been vegan.
Has a kind of...
It has definite environmental benefits, climate benefits. You haven't got five times as much grain being grown on five times as much land, so that 80% of it gets wasted in the conversion inside the animal. One of the documents produced for the camp goes through this in more depth. One of the simple figure it points out is that a typical Western diet takes about a third of a hectare. A vegetarian diet takes far less than half of that acreage, and a vegan diet, you cut it by half again. So a vegan diet, you know, uses only 20% of the land. And when a lot of that land is in overseas countries where they should be growing food for themselves rather than growing food to fly over to here, not necessarily to feed people but to feed the animals, it's just such a wasteful, criminally wasteful system. And then you also have, from a climate perspective, you have problems with the methane emissions from both ends of the cattle. They're giving off methane. To raise the amount of feed needed to feed those number of animals, you need to have intensive systems which often are dependent on petrochemicals in terms of soil improvements, fertilizing, that kind of thing. You have all the energy involved in converting the meat, carrying it, washing it, chilling it. If you're carrying pulses and grains and such like, again, it doesn't need refrigeration, but meat needs to be refrigerated in every stage of its operations, which is yet more energy use. So, you know, from every kind of perspective, it's the way to go. And hopefully, one of the things that the camp is demonstrating, as with all the other aspects of sustainable lifestyle the camp aims to demonstrate, is that it's very easy to do, and it's fun and peripherally accessible. You know, we make a point of trying to make food which people recognise. We've been eating pizza, we've been eating bolognese, spaghetti and pasta, and, you know, just normal foods.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen to have the meat in it. And people, we find in the environmental movement, and we do personally do work with the peace movement and human rights groups and such like, that there's a general understanding that, maybe not in their own personal lifestyle at home, but there's a general understanding that in kind of the campaign environment, that it's a perfectly acceptable way to go, and people, you know, we've had no objections here at all. Everyone's understood it to be perfectly sensible, reasonable thing to do, which as a vegan campaigner is very gratifying, because when we started that 20 years ago, no one knew what a vegan was, and these days everyone in the society at large knows what vegan is, and increasingly they're coming to understand why, as well as what. So it's a good, you know, a good step forward. In quite a short space of time, that acceptance has come about. Still, obviously, to the world at large, there's a long way to go in terms of getting the detail of why it's the right thing to do, and you know, increasingly trying to get across the understanding that it's a perfectly enjoyable thing to do in terms of the kinds of food that can be produced. Burgers and salads and pies and everything else is all there these days, so it's quite easy to do.
So the Vegan Society, you just pulled out the new brochure, which explains all the environmental benefits in quite.
That's right.
Quite
the Vegan Society, vegansociety.com, have got a 16-page booklet which fully referenced, which tells you everything you need to know.
Right. You know, I think if you looked at the carbon footprint of your meal compared to anybody else, you know, an average UK
Western
person, you know, it would be like a tiny fraction.
But
there's still a residual bit of energy use. You're still using a bit of gas
this is one of the challenges we have to face up with, is at the moment we are pretty much tied into propane as being our energy source. I mean, gas is cleaner than, say, coal or, you know, running a nuclear-powered electric oven or whatever. Obviously, we're saving vast amounts of energy elsewhere down the line because of all the other energy savings in the system. We're forever kind of, when we go to things like other green gatherings and such like, we always kind of look at what's happening in terms of the people who are further ahead of us in terms of clay ovens and wood-powered stoves and all this kind of stuff. Log-burning stoves would be a good way to go because they can be made quite simply in, you know, this kind of low-tech forges that green people are reviving these kind of industries in a field situation. There are positive advantages of burning wood because if you're burning wood and growing more wood, then you're keeping at least even carbon neutral, but in fact beyond that you're actually encouraging a woodland based industry, so you actually have, you know, probably positive benefits there, but it's just a question of having the time, the knowledge, the energy, the investment to start going that way, you know.
And there's an increasing fashion almost for more raw food. People are actually, it's coming over from the States,
A lot of people are going that way in terms of the, you know, the energy value and the nutritional value of the food.
So yeah, you're also composting, I guess.
Yeah, we're composting. There's local organic farms taking the raw food. Anybody can compost all their vegetable trimmings and all their raw food in their own grounds or even in their kitchen in a wormery kind of system. Cooked food is more difficult, but of course, because the food is so delish, there's very little cooked food left anyway because everyone's eating it because it's so nice.
Another thing, I'm guessing, because I've only just arrived and I'm hoping to eat one of your meals shortly, but you're not using processed foods, so you're having bangers and mash, but you're making your own bangers, so that again is an energy saving.
That's it, yep. I suppose the most, I would say the only processed or the most processed thing would be soya. We do have some soya protein type of stuff, but there is some processing involved in that, but everything else is basic commodities cooked on site, other than maybe bread, which is cooked 10 miles away. One other element is in that kind of general areas, there's the water, the cooking water, the washing up water, all the waters are going through a grey water system, so it's not going out into any sewerage, which would involve all the processing and being pumped MC or whatever they might do with it around here, but it's actually being processed on site in a grey water system, which simply involves filtering it through a series of on site filter beds. Firstly, 24 hours soaked with local ditch water, so all the local microorganisms from the local environment get into the wood chip and get it started. We're certainly, it's one of the things we've gained from the climate camp is the enthusiasm to go back and set up a grey water system at our Sumat Centre in Nottingham, because the climate camp isn't just about targeting a big power station on one day. It's putting a demonstration of the kind of society that we're looking towards when the crunch comes, and as it will do when the climate crisis really hits. You know, we all have to either have a post-crunch society based on conflict and war and the biggest and toughest and strongest grabbing what they can and everyone else having to basically starve, or we have to start working towards a society where we learn to share our resources, to minimise our impact. So that's what the camp is to do with, really. It's to do with all of us learning from each other all of these sort of sustainable systems, mm-hmm. taking them back to our communities and sharing these ideas with our neighbours.
You're the toilet expert of the camp.
Well, I was asked to come up with a system to deal with the toilets, on generally sanitation on the site. The main limitation we have, like for compost toilets, is that we have to take everything off site at the end, which obviously kind of like creates like a, like could be quite messy, like when you're talking about like compost toilets. Also, like when you're building compost toilets, normally you just put them onto a site, and basically you leave it there stationary, and then basically like the stuff has time to break down in its own time.
It takes a matter of weeks or months, or
A year, roughly. Okay. Like generally, people advise like leave it for a year. So often, what people build is like two compartments. Use one at a time. Once that's full, go on to the next one, and once the second one is full, the first one generally is empty again, you know. So it's important to get the number, like the volume right for the number of people who are going to use it, obviously.
So how many toilets did you end up?
We built 20 because we expected about 2,000 people or anything up to 2,000 people. So to be prepared for that, we built like 20 toilets in like squares of four, so like four in a cube in a block, and dotted them around the sides, kind of thing. You could build the same thing kind of in a stationary thing. I just rather, well, we decided on using wheelie bins because obviously they're enclosed and also quite easy to transport around the site. At the end of the camp, we just take them off, and local farmers are friendly enough to agree we can compost it on his land, you know. And I mean, for him it's a resource, you know. He can actually use it like in a year's time or a bit. It can go on to his fruit crops on like and can be dug into the ground, you know. So that's we're in this absurd situation that's kind of what is actually like a like fertility resource, which like basically should be returned back to the land, is being seen as a problem in our society. It's flushed away with drinking quality water, which has been expensively purified, you know, like chemically treated and what have you. And that water is the same water we're drinking out of the tap. It's used to flush away through our toilet, you know, and which is absurd if you think about it. If the two can be separated, then both are precious resources, you know. Another thing we were careful was like to separate urine and like solid waste, because if you mix the two together, then again, like it's obviously quite messy, you know. You have a lot of volume to deal with.
So you had a different solution for
We built urinals separately, which is as these straw bales, and we had a brilliant like women design team on kind of for a couple of days thinking about like how to do the women's urinals, because obviously kind of they're kind of have different needs, you know. And so after 2 days, they came up with this excellent system of basically like just like a wooden structure where kind of women can like have like pee in comfort. Men are quite used to standing in a hedge, you know, and kind of but we still put the straw belts down because again, it soaks up the pee and makes it a very good fertilizer. You know, the mixture of straw and urine is kind of.
So again, that will go back to farms.
Again, it'll go to the same farm, and it'll cover the dry compost, and so there is, kind of it'll be a excellent mixture for like composting down in not too long time.
So, what have you? Have people responded well to your designs?
A lot of people seem to like it, you know, because in outdoor events, like usually, what you've got with either you've got chemical toilets, which very quickly start to smell very bad, because I mean they have the problem that like urine and crap goes into the same container, so there is no separation and it starts to smell quite quickly. Or the other, like in like low impact gatherings, often have like pits, you know, which for other reasons aren't ideal. You know, obviously you have to dig a lot and kind of you cover it up in the end, so you in a way you're losing the resource. Whereas like if you have a proper compost toilet, then you're gaining a resource, you know.
So have you got a permaculture background?
Yeah. I mean, I've been working with permaculture, like design, for 12 years. So yeah.
And besides their application on festivals, what scope do you see for people starting to use them in kind of ordinary domestic situations?
Well, I mean, dry composting toilets. If you've got a garden that is big enough, then there's no reason why you couldn't have one. Generally, you say like a couple of cubic meters is enough for a family, you know. So like if you build it up and then you have like two compartments, then it doesn't actually take up too much space, you know, and you kind of live like next to your house or whatever. So that'd be possible. It's like for sites like allotments or, you know, any like outdoor areas, you know, like in countries like Sweden or Norway, like they're quite commonplace in like national parks and places like that, you know, so they're actually standard, you know, they're actually are obliged to have these rather than having flush toilets, because it's acknowledged that that is the most ecological way of dealing with human waste.
Yeah,
yeah,
that'd be great to have it here. And the is there anything else you've had responsibility for?
Don't know whether you've seen the grey water system, you know, that was another
design system. I saw one of the grey water systems out the back of the Nottingham cookery tent. Which seemed to be working well. So the whole site is bypassing the general sewage system.
We're, apart from water, we're not mains connected and there is no need for it. So we have no mains power, we've got no mains sewage, any of that, yeah.
So we've got a standpipe licence. We are getting pressured mains water.
Right.
But that's it. That's our only request. Yeah. And obviously, if we were here long term, we could set up rainwater catchers.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about that on the website, and maybe getting drain pipes around the marquees and.
Yeah, but it's doable. Or even just like rolling up the edges of the marquees and fixing them.
So that it gels.
Even easier, yeah.
And then there's lots of ways to purify water that's been collected off the roofs of structures. Mm-hmm. The various like porcelain filters you can buy, or cheaper systems you can build up primitive but effective condensers, where it condenses and then comes back, and obviously what comes back is very pure.
Mm-hmm. So potentially you could have drinking water on site from rainwater.
If it's a permanent site, then that's definitely possible. Yeah. We're looking into producing a manual actually for low impact sites and low impact events, where like a lot of those solutions like will be gathered, and so people can just take that away, and like if people want to run an event or like set up a site, then they got it all in a pack.
Sounds like a great idea.
You've been listening to Voices from the Camp for Climate Action, recorded back in August here on the 2 Degrees Show. Another camp is being planned for next summer, and the next organising meeting is in January in Yorkshire. Full details can be found on the camp's website, along with a whole bunch of other fascinating and inspirational material, at www.climatecamp.org.uk. That's www.climatecamp.org.uk. And if you want to listen to this program again, you'll find it archived at coinnet.org.uk/climate radio. That's coinnet.org.uk/climate radio.